The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
The US president appears to be increasingly disheartened over his chances of fulfilling that campaign pledge of an end of the war between Russia and Ukraine. Of course, this comes at a time when Washington has halted shipments of military aid to Ukraine, including the all-important Patriot air defence missiles. Last night, Kyiv was subject to an intense drone barrage, with Russia launching 550 drones and 11 missiles. It's the most ever launched. On the line, James Waterhouse, who's the BBC Ukraine correspondent. If Putin was trying to send a message to Donald Trump, I think it was quite clear from what happened last night, James.
Well, I absolutely agree. And actually, I think the subtlety of the Kremlin trying to warm relations with Washington whilst continuing to wage its war is now a thing of the past. You now have Vladimir Putin telling Donald Trump straight, look, I'm not going to stop until all of my goals are completed. The Kremlin believes, or is telling the world, that as long as there can be no political solution to what it still calls a special military operation, then it will continue to invade Ukraine and take as much of it as possible. And what does Donald Trump say in response? He says he's disappointed. He realizes Vladimir Putin isn't there, in his words. Does he threaten the sanctions, the extra sanctions that Ukraine desperately wants to see? No. If anything, he has only stopped more military support for Ukraine, where vital air defence systems, ammunition, have been paused mid-air or stuck on an airfield in Poland. I'm just reading through a readout from President Zelensky from his own phone call with Donald Trump, where you would imagine he has brought up the issue of paused military aid, but there is no mention. They simply talk about, he commended Donald Trump for being well-informed on the invasion. They talked about working together in the future. And so you have this kind of political inertia where ultimately, in the middle of it all, Ukraine's position only worsens.
We'll talk in a bit about what it's like for people who are in Ukraine right now, just going about their ordinary daily lives. But if that aid, if that military assistance doesn't come soon, that is going to play into Russia's hands, because they're going to be able to do more with drones and more with missiles because they know they're going to get through.
Absolutely. And I think it's a story of crude numbers when you are talking about these airstrikes and Ukraine's ability to defend against them. I'm not saying we're going to suddenly see a collapsing of the front line in certain areas. Things, yes, aren't going Ukraine's way, and Russia is inching forward at an enormous human cost. But what Moscow is also doing is manufacturing these drones that continually evolve, but a relatively cheap cost compared to a ballistic missile. They can manufacture them at the same rate that they are launching them at cities across Ukraine. So you've just said, you know, there were more than 500 launched last night. The last weekend I was in Kyiv, over three nights, more than 1,000 were launched. And each time the Ukrainians has to launch a missile from a Patriot system or use 50 caliber anti-aircraft fire or other missiles launched at the sky, their resources are far more limited than the Russians. And so once the Ukrainians run out, you will see drones packed with 100 kilos of explosives, for example, take whole chunks out of apartment blocks and devastate lives. And it's a scene that Ukrainians have seen time and time again.
Where the concern must lie in Kyiv at the moment is that Trump isn't getting anywhere in negotiating with Russia. It's quite clear that Russia is going to keep going. The fear would be that Donald Trump essentially shrugs his shoulders and walks away rather than perhaps trying to support Ukraine. And then they'd be left on their own with a bit of support from Europe, but not much.
I think that's right. I think when you look at the pausing of this military aid, my read on it is that he is actually looking to act as a catalyst and bring this war to some kind of conclusion, regardless of the favour it falls into. You know, Donald Trump, it was a campaign pledge to end it in a day. I think he knew that wouldn't happen. But if you're Ukraine, you're looking at American interventionism with Iran, where America has shown what it is capable of when it comes to air superiority and airstrikes, and when it wants to back an ally like Israel, or when Israel's other allies come to its aid and defend its skies against Iranian missiles. Ukraine is genuinely wondering how it is different. It is a European country. It is seeking to align with the West. it is ultimately a democracy trying to free itself of Moscow's orbit. And yet, on some ideological level, for Donald Trump, which I think Kyiv is still trying to decipher, we know he's been a fan of Vladimir Putin, but he doesn't have the appetite or patience to either understand the detail of why Russia is invading Ukraine and is the aggressor, and what it takes to potentially give the Ukraine the support it needs. Because you could argue that the war of the last 11 years and counting is a consequence of the West's inability or unwillingness to take a tougher stance on Moscow, and that only emboldens Putin.
James Waterhouse, BBC Ukraine correspondent, thank you very much for joining us. Let's speak to Donico Bacon, who is the professor of politics at Dublin City University. He's just back, in fact, from Ukraine. What is the mood like amongst the ordinary Ukrainians? I know you were in the west of the country, which is away from the front line, but this must be taking a terrible toll, Donico.
No, it is taking a terrible toll, and you only have to visit the local graveyard, as I did, to see that toll. I mean, the Ukrainians have a tradition, which we don't really have so much in Ireland, of putting large photographs on gravestones. And it really gives you a sense of the huge loss of life that has occurred, which spans different ages, from the very young to the middle aged to the quite old, who have all died, defending their homeland. And as you say, I was in the west of Ukraine. It was far from the front line. But the size of this new graveyard, they had to create a new graveyard to accommodate all these deaths, gives you some sense of that this is what it's like far from the front line, what it's like at the front line. But at the same time, the Ukrainians, despite being resilient and proud and defiant, and indeed mobilized, the entire society is mobilized against the Russian invasion, they've managed to do that without, after many years, losing their sense of humanity. Life still goes on in the most mundane senses of the world. Where I was staying was right beside a kindergarten, for example, and I couldn't help but notice that at 9 o'clock in the morning, you have this kind of minute where there's this tick-tocking sound that is throughout the city, and the whole of the city comes to a standstill, and the children in the kindergarten were brought out to pay attention to this. And then after that, and this is in memory of all those who have lost their lives during this Russian full-scale invasion, and then you would have a playing of the national anthem, and then people would get back as much as they can to their normal lives. So it's a very kind of perverse sense of reality. I mean, as I said, people have to get on with their lives. You know, people are still going about their normal jobs. But at the same time, there's this air of unreality that they don't know when and how they can be hit. And as James mentioned, I experienced the same kind of sirens where I was. You wake up in the middle of the night hearing these very loud sirens. You're asked to go down to the cellars. And you don't know until the missiles are much closer, the drones are much closer, whether it's going to hit your city or not. And this is a nightly experience for most Ukrainians.
How are the young people dealing with this? I mean, you talked about the kindergarten. Is it that they are very aware there's something going on? But it must be almost omnipresent, this sense of threat that we've been talking about.
It is. I mean, for Ukrainians, it's like living next to a volcano. I mean, it's I can only describe it like that. You feel the tremors. You don't know whether this time there'll be an absolute eruption or whether it'll stay as tremors. But you live in this kind of constant sense of tribulation. And as I said, you don't necessarily get used to it, but you try and not internalize it to such an extent that it paralyzes your interactions with your family. I mean, parents have to be very brave with their children. I mean, on the one hand, they have to let them know that their parents are often away protecting them, even though they can't be at home. But at the same time, they have to protect them from the worst things that happen. They can't kind of make them adults before it's time. And of course, every year that passes, a new cohort of people come on to the mobilization stream where they have to go and defend their country. And I think what really strikes you when you're in the graveyard and seeing those faces and seeing the young people nearby at the kindergartens is the futility of it all and the outrage of it all, that this is so unnecessary, that this is so arbitrary, that it's the choice of essentially one person who has decided that Ukraine is not a country. Indeed, many Russians would concur with that, and that they are determined, as the Kremlin said last night after their meeting with Donald Trump, not to back down in their quest to subdue Ukraine. So Ukrainians have this sense that there's this kind of very large, powerful country with nuclear weapons, with one of the largest armies in the world, which doesn't believe they have a right to exist. And as you can imagine, it's very hard to sleep well at night when you know you have such a neighbour?
The question really goes to what happens next? Because there is a hierarchy of misery, as we know. And in news terms, it was focused on Iran recently. You know, it is quite rightly turning back to Gaza at the moment. If it wasn't for this barrage, Ukraine wouldn't have been spoken about today. Do the people of Ukraine feel that they are somewhat down towards the bottom of that hierarchy right now? And do they realise the risk of that, that the world might not be paying attention?
Oh, no, they're very keenly aware of it. And I would say quite frustrated with it. I would be more frustrated were I them, but they're very frustrated because they feel that this is not just an attack on them. This is an attack happening in the heart of Europe. And they feel that they are not, you know, just fighting Russia on their own behalf, that they are fighting on Europe's behalf. I mean, I interviewed the president of Moldova, for example, the country neighboring Ukraine, and she's quite candid in saying that Moldova survives only today because Ukraine has prevented Russian forces from advancing even further. I mean, people in Estonia feel very worried. People in Poland have mobilized. Their army is going to be approaching 500,000 people very soon. They're spending 5% of their economy on defense. We have North Koreans, you know, all the way from the Pacific Ocean, who have come to the heart of Europe to fight Russia's war in Ukraine. We have Iranian drones which are showered down on Ukraine every night. And they wonder, how can we talk about war fatigue in Paris, in London, in Dublin, places that are completely unaffected by war? You know, we're just, you know, people, they get the sense that, oh, it's like a soap opera that's gone on too long. They just wish that this, you know, the saga would kind of wrap up and move along. In that sense, they share the impatience that Trump sometimes displays, that, you know, why can't these people just sort it all out and we can all get back to our lives? And that's frustrating, as I said, when people see their loved ones, you know, under threat every day of the week. And they see this fatigue from people who haven't suffered, as I said, at all as a result of this war.
Dunica O'Bacon, Professor of Politics at Dublin City University. Thanks very much for joining us to talk about that. Also the author of a book, Unfinished Empire, Russian Imperialism in Ukraine and the Near Abroad. I do get the sense that, you know, we're losing interest in the Ukrainian war because of so many other things that are appalling us and making us feel disgusted with the world right now. It's not going to end well if that is the approach that we manage or somehow are forced to take in the West.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.